Welcome to another episode of the Oncology On The Go podcast. I'm your host, Roman Fabricator. In this episode, Cancer Network's Ariana Pelosi spoke with Kelly A. Roan, an advanced practice nurse of gastrointestinal oncology at the Mayo Clinic in Phoenix, Arizona, about the current state of pancreatic cancer, emphasizing risk factors, diagnostic challenges, and treatment planning. First, Roan discussed counseling for both modifiable and non-modifiable risk factors for pancreatic cancer, as well as diagnostic challenges in differentiating pancreatic diseases from cancer, highlighting a need for more effective screening tools for this patient subgroup. Roan further explored treatment planning and managing treatment-related adverse events, with an emphasis placed on managing food consumption in spite of appetite loss. Additionally, Roan discussed palliative care for pancreatic cancer, highlighting her role in educating patients on its benefits across patient subgroups. She then explored addressing psychosocial needs for patients and their loved ones before covering what she hoped to observe for the future of pancreatic cancer treatment. She concluded by emphasizing a need to educate patients on distinguishing between pancreatic adenocarcinoma and pancreatic neuroendocrine cancer, noting a distinction in prognoses.
Okay, so just to start off, how do you assess and counsel patients regarding modifiable or non-modifiable risk factors for pancreatic cancer?
Well, I think we need to start with education. I don't think a lot of people think about pancreas cancer as something that they will ever get. I think most people think about the more common types of cancer, colon, breast, prostate. And so I think education about modifiable versus non-modifiable is the starting place. But once people know what those are, of course, you know, they're the usual things. You should not smoke because it increases your risk by 2 times the risk of non-smokers. So you have double the risk if you're a smoker. Obesity is also a risk. If you have diabetes, I think a lot of people don't realize that when you're newly diagnosed with diabetes, that increases your risk of developing pancreas cancer. We don't really know by how much, but it is something that people should be aware of. Certainly people who have chronic pancreatitis, those people are also at a greater risk of developing pancreas cancer. And if someone is having recurrent pancreatitis, one of their providers should say to them, hey, we got to get this better controlled or you're going to develop, you know, you're at risk. Modifying the behaviors that cause you to develop pancreatitis, excessive drinking, those kinds of things. Patients should be aware that pancreatitis increases their risk. There is, you know, some information on exposures to chemicals. So if you work in a workplace that exposes you to chemicals, sometimes that's difficult to control, but maybe discussions with your employer about, hey, how do we protect ourselves from the use of these chemicals? For people who have non-modifiable risks, so a lot of the genetic syndromes that predispose you, those people should be screened in a different way, and they just need to be aware of how the screening should proceed.
Perfect. So what are the most common diagnostic challenges in differentiating pancreatic cancer from other pancreatic diseases? And how has that role of imaging and biomarkers evolved in staging?
That is one of the great difficulties with pancreas cancer. There are really no good screening tools that have been proven to be highly effective. One of the difficulties with pancreas cancer is that a lot of people are diagnosed at a later or more advanced stage. And so that is a big area of study as to, you know, how do we find these cancers earlier? And there really isn't a clear answer. So we do know that people who have certain genetic risk factors. So people who have BRCA2, there's some other genetic abnormalities that predispose people. So people who have PALB2 are at higher risk. People who have Lynch syndrome, I just learned during my research for this that there's Lynch syndrome 1 and Lynch syndrome 2. I didn't know anything about that. Lynch syndrome 2 patients are at a greater risk. I don't actually know what distinguishes Lynch syndrome 1 from Lynch syndrome 2, but apparently I need to learn that. There is something called Peutz Jaeger syndrome, that those patients are at a higher risk of developing pancreas cancer along with a lot of other health issues. And so those patients should be screened a little bit more closely. For even people who have these genetic predispositions or the higher risk factors, so people with pancreatitis, there hasn't been a definitive answer on what's the best way to monitor these patients, mainly because it could be that it's something that is invasive. So if someone has chronic pancreatitis, their pancreas is inflamed all of the time, that makes imaging a lot more difficult. So if you have all this inflammation, how do you see past the inflammation to see if there's a tumor? And so, do we do CT scans regularly on these patients? Do we do an MRI? Is that better? I don't think anybody really knows. A lot of patients are not entirely interested in going through an endoscopic ultrasound, which is an invasive procedure that requires sedation. Some people are not really willing to sign up for that. As far as biomarkers, also a challenge, we have difficulty with that even in people who have a known diagnosis of pancreas cancer. The most common tumor marker that we use for pancreas cancer is CA19-9. And we'll have patients who have a normal CA19-9 when we know they have a pancreas cancer. We have patients who have these erratic tumor markers when we're treating them for pancreas cancer. Their tumor marker may be up for reasons that we don't really understand, causes a lot of anxiety for people. So I don't know that it's not like a PSA test where we know if you have an elevated PSA, you have something wrong with your prostate. It's not that clear in patients who have pancreas cancer. There's lots of research looking for circulating tumor DNA. Can we find the golden ticket that tells us that this person has a greater risk so they can be followed more closely? But we haven't really found that yet. There are actually multiple studies underway that they are using the fluid from fine needle aspirations for people who have known pancreatic cancer to see if they can identify markers that may be used for screening or for following these patients. But one of the great difficulties with pancreas cancer is that it's a fairly rare cancer, and we don't have a lot of people to do this study on. And so it takes a lot longer to get to the information quantity of data that we need to really prove something. And so it may take a while.
That's great. I think the biomarker aspect's really interesting too, where there's not something that like directly leads to a diagnosis.
There's companies that are looking at tumor DNA, Natera and Guardant and Caris. Those are really good markers for things like colorectal cancer, and they haven't identified what we need to follow for pancreas cancer.
Hopefully something soon with all this research will come out of it. So can you describe what your role is in the treatment planning phase for patients with pancreatic cancer?
So usually by the time I get to see the patient for the first time, they have seen the oncologist and have most likely started on treatment. The management of patients are different based on whether they're diagnosed as metastatic or if they are thought to be resectable. I actually think the patients who have this designation of what's called borderline resectable, it's the hardest place to be in because those patients, they're working towards surgery in order to be potentially cured, but only about 25% of those patients actually make it to resection, which means 75% of them don't. I spend a lot of time trying to educate patients, both the possibly resectable and the metastatic patients, about what kind of happens with cancer in general, that cancer is a mutating entity and that we really don't know how their cancer is going to respond. Pancreas cancer is typically not overly responsive to chemotherapy, in that, when we treat people who have colon cancer or breast cancer, lung cancer, those cancers tend to shrink dramatically when they start treatment. Pancreas cancer doesn't really do that. And so I manage people's expectations to let them know, don't be disappointed if your cancer has only decreased by 10%. We think that's good. I mean, we don't think it's great, but it's better than it being larger. A lot of people come in thinking that their cancer is going to shrink away to nothing. And we have to educate people about that. So I kind of try to manage people's expectations. If a patient has imaging, you know, a CT scan or a PET scan or something, and their cancer looks worse, I will discuss with the oncologist what the next step in their treatment might be, and then educate patients on what the new side effects might be.
Great. So you did just previously discuss the most common adverse effects. So can you go into a little bit more about how you manage those AEs for those patients?
There's a variety of those. One of the things that sometimes people will have prior to coming in, or one of the things that leads them to their diagnosis, is pain. Sometimes people will have upper abdominal pain, or they'll have mid back pain. And that's what leads to their diagnosis. A lot of times just treating their cancer will make that better, but it may take, you know, a couple of treatments before they get to where their symptoms have improved. And so we will do management of pain. So is it something that has to be treated with something like an opioid or other analgesics? Or can we send them for what's called a celiac plexus block, where they have a procedure that numbs the cluster of nerves that are kind of located near the pancreas that helps improve their pain. A lot of patients will have appetite issues. There's something about pancreas cancer that just crushes people's appetite. One of the things that happens with a lot of patients before they get diagnosed is they lose a bunch of weight. And part of that is because their appetite is suppressed. When we give chemotherapy, that tends to not help. Chemotherapy often will make foods taste weird, or, you know, make it hard to eat. We try to encourage people to eat small, frequent meals. We might connect them with dietitians. We will sometimes use an appetite stimulant. But a lot of times I just have to convince people that you need to eat when it's a meal time, because you don't have that trigger that tells you to eat. So you may have to schedule it, for lack of a better term. I often tell patients, your job now is to eat. So you have to look, you know, set a goal. I'm going to eat 3 meals today and plan for it. And the people who do that tend to do better. So patients who have pancreas cancer will often develop pancreatic insufficiency. And so there's a lot of GI issues that occur with that. They'll get diarrhea, lots of gas, bloating. Sometimes people will say, I don't know what's happening. And this pancreatic insufficiency is one of the reasons why people develop, have such weight loss, is because they're not processing the food properly. And so I start a lot of people on pancreatic enzyme in an effort to eliminate some of their GI issues, or improve their GI issues and help their nutritional status by better absorption of the food.
I think that point's really interesting. I just actually spoke with a nurse who specializes in multiple myeloma. And her big thing is to make a meal an event, to try and make people excited to eat. So I think it's interesting, like, seeing your different tips and tricks across the different cancer types there.
Yeah. I tell people, especially caregivers, it's very frustrating for caregivers, especially when it's the wife who is the caregiver, because we feed people to make them better. And it's really distressing to caregivers when they can't make people better by making them eat. So I've had conversations with people who are doing the meal preparation. Most of these caregivers are like, I'll fix whatever, or I'll go get them whatever they want. But then by the time it's ready or available, the patient's like, I don't want it anymore. Or they take two bites and they say, oh, it tastes terrible. And so then it's just not appealing. But I also tell patients, you know, no eating in the bed, no eating at the chair, watching TV. You make it seem like a meal time. So go to the table, have it like you would eat a normal meal. And because that will trick your brain into thinking, okay, it's time to eat. I just need to eat. And, you know, it's meal time, I'm at the table. And sometimes that will help people eat a little bit more.
No, I think that's really important, and sometimes not always thought about when trying to mitigate these effects there.
Yeah, because when you don't eat, that really increases your fatigue and it makes people feel really terrible. And so I try to convince people to think of food as fuel. And if you're not putting any gas in your tank, you're not going to have any energy to go. So think of your meals as your fuel.
What are some of the key components of palliative care for this population? And how do you help transition patients into this phase?
Anyone with a pancreas cancer diagnosis, even, you know, if they're resectable or if they're incurable, should be connected with palliative medicine. I try to get people in as soon as possible One of the difficulties is that when people are first getting the diagnosis, they have a million different appointments that they have to go to. You know, they got to have the gastroenterologist to have their biopsy. You know, they got to see the surgeon. They got to see the oncologist. They have to see all these people. And when you say to them, I really think you would benefit from seeing a palliative care specialist, they say, I don't want another doctor. I don't want another visit. Some people come in and they're like, yeah, I want to do anything I can to make my life better. And those patients are easy. You know, we get them right into palliative care, but some people we kind of have to ease them into it. And so we are doing a lot of their palliative care from the beginning. With palliative care, there's a lot of education that has to be utilized to explain to people what palliative care is. And so a lot of times when you say to someone, I think you should get seen by palliative medicine, they're like, why? Am I dying? Is that, you know, does that mean I'm not going to survive this? You have to educate people that know palliative care does a lot more than just end of life things. And I will explain to patients, they'll say, well, you're managing my nausea. Yeah, I am. And I'm managing your pain, but they have a whole extra set of skills that they might do better. So, and you know, fatigue is one of the main things that a lot of our patients, not just our pancreas cancer patients, but a lot of our patients, they're just tired. And I tell them that palliative medicine has some tricks that will help, maybe help their fatigue. And so I try to make it seem more like a supportive care aspect of their care and used to make things better. There is a lot of research that people who get involved with palliative care early have a longer and a better life expectancy. And so, you know, I try not to say to people, hey, you might live longer if you go into palliative care, but I, you know, I try to get to that point that especially for patients who are metastatic, we know that if we get you involved early in palliative medicine, that will extend your life. In that regard, most people are kind of interested in going.
Yeah, I think it definitely comes down to the education, because I hear palliative care and I do think more end of life than helping to better your life expectancy and whatnot.
Yeah, some people used to refer to palliative care as pre-hospice. And, you know, I cringe every time I hear that because it's really so much more than that. And we just need, it's such a new branch of medicine that we really just have to educate people about it.
How do you help to address those unique psychosocial needs for patients and their families when dealing with pancreatic cancer?
Well, I think you have to assess what their situation is. When you learn a little bit more about your patient, then you care a little bit more about them. And not that we shouldn't care about our patients, but for people who have metastatic disease, it makes it a lot more difficult because you know the trajectory. But it's also important that you guide people through that, because we're seeing more and more young people, not so much with pancreas cancer, though we are seeing younger people with pancreas cancer. If they have young kids, you know, and do they have a wife who doesn't work? You kind of got to, you know, address the financial aspects of someone passing away from their cancer. You have to do, and this is one of the things that palliative medicine does really well, is you do letter writing and legacy building. And I really understand that you may not want to get chemotherapy because you feel crummy. And so if you choose not to get treated, I want you to be aware of the implications of that, that, you know, somewhere along the way, you may start having symptoms from your cancer and we won't be able to reverse that. And so you have to be frank with people. Chemotherapy is hard. If you don't want to do it, I get it. But here's what happens if you don't, so that you're fully informed as to what may happen. And so I think we have to not think of people as just their cancer. You have to think of them as how their cancer is affecting their life. You have to ask those questions. And there are, you know, a lot of the electronic medical records kind of probe into that, but I don't know that everybody is really disclosing, well, I'm, you know, I have to keep working because if I don't, I lose my insurance. We are very lucky where I work that we have excellent social workers who kind of help us with those kinds of issues. We have child life specialists if you've got young children, but you got to ask the question, do we have any issues? And, you know, as you see people for a longer period of time, they disclose more of it. But we have to remember that our patients are people, not just their cancer.
Great. Thank you for sharing that with me. I think it humanizes the whole aspect of it a little bit more.
For sure.
So, looking ahead, how do you hope to see this field evolve within the next 5 to 10 years?
I hope that we can find a way to detect things sooner. I read something that was interesting. I actually wrote it down. One of the studies that I was looking at for how, the development of biomarkers, one of the things they pointed out in this article was because pancreas cancer is so rare, a primary care doctor may only see one or two patients who have pancreas cancer in their entire medical career, which is not very much. And so a lot of the symptoms are so vague that you can attribute it to a lot of stuff. Oh, I'm having lots of heartburn. I have this weird feeling in my stomach. And so they think it's reflux. And so they give them a proton pump inhibitor and move on. There was one article where they were working on a program for kind of shifting people from primary care into a clinic using these decision support tools, like if this, then this. They were developing a clinic to send people to kind of do a further workup. I don't know if that's feasible, but so educating people. One of the other areas that was really interesting is they found in the last several years that people who have diabetes kind of later in life. So they found that people who develop diabetes have an increased risk of developing diabetes within the next 2 to 3 years. And so they're looking at how do we screen people who have a newly diagnosed diabetes for pancreas cancer. They haven't really figured that out yet. So we really need to figure out how do we find it sooner because we know people who get diagnosed early. I think the patients who I've found that do the best, their cancer's found by accident at an early stage. They do the best. So we know people who get diagnosed at stage one or two do better. So we need to figure out how to make that happen. But we also need to figure out how to make chemotherapy work better. Pancreas cancer is not super responsive to chemotherapy. And how do we make the cancer that people develop respond better?
And then finally, is there anything else you wanted to highlight today?
So I would point out one thing, because I don't think a lot of people know this. There is a distinction between pancreatic adenocarcinoma and pancreatic neuroendocrine cancer or neuroendocrine tumors. At our institution, we have a pancreatic cancer support group, but we let anyone who have a pancreas cancer come. And so we have a mix of people who have neuroendocrine cancer and adenocarcinoma. I'll have patients say, "Well, you've been telling me I'm going to die from my cancer or my cancer's not good. How come I go to this cancer support group and there's somebody in here who's been getting treated for their pancreas cancer for 10 years?" And I'll say to them, "Because you got the bad kind of cancer. Adenocarcinoma is much more difficult, much more rapidly growing, much harder to treat than neuroendocrine tumors. Not that neuroendocrine tumors are, a good cancer, but they are more indolent and a little bit easier to treat, more treatment options than people who have adenocarcinoma. So I think it's important that people be educated on the differences between the two cancers."
All right, great. Thank you so much. That was everything I had for you today.
Don't forget to subscribe to the Oncology on the Go podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere podcasts are available, or listen online at cancernetwork.com/resources/podcast. The Oncology on the Go podcast is the official podcast of cancernetwork.com, the home of the journal Oncology. For more information, visit us at cancernetwork.com and find us on Twitter at Cancer Network without the O, or on Facebook and LinkedIn at Cancer Network.